This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Dose.com. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. Got to give another huge thanks to the awesome response to the 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness Bracket. A ton of work with lots of individuals went into this idea. So I love the feedback, the participation. Thank you, thank you. If you want to vote on which is the most influential, important, and best trial in critical care history, remember, voting is happening right now on Twitter or Instagram at Pharmacy2Dose, T-O-2Dose. Now, today, right, this is part two in the episode series, Pharmacotherapy in the Critically Ill Pregnant Patient. Now, part one focuses on more ICU-specific disease states and considerations, so be sure to listen to that episode if you haven't already. But now, these episodes are based on the Caring for Two in the ICU two-part article series published in Pharmacotherapy. So if you haven't yet, be sure to download those PDFs. They're going to be a tremendous resource for a lot of people and tons of familiar pharmacist authors, friends of the pod, on the author list. So Mojda Hefner, Brooke Barlow, Carolyn McGee Bell, Grace Erdman, Anthony Hawkins, Susan Smith, and many, many more. But the two senior authors on part one and part two, respectively, Melissa Thompson-Basson and Dr. Allison Langford. So they're gracious enough to spend a significant amount of time going into detail on this topic. So we're going to use the pharmacotherapy articles as a guide, right? Specifically, this one will focus on part two. But we're also going to let Melissa and Allie go into detail on things that might not have made the final publication full text. Researching information into the care of the critically ill pregnant patient is so challenging. So very, very grateful for these authors creating this tremendous resource, right? If you ever looked for information on this issue specifically, it's almost impossible. Now, today's episode, Pharmacotherapy in the Critically Ill Pregnant Patient Part 2, focuses on the management of pregnancy-related complications in the ICU. So we review what's the most common cause for ICU admission. We work our way through a virtual obstetric hemorrhage kit highlighting pharmacotherapy considerations, discuss the use of magnesium and preeclampsia, blood pressure-specific goals, agents to use, big picture take-home points, and so, so much more. So Melissa and Allie continue their masterclass on pharmacotherapy in the critically ill pregnant patient with part two, which starts right now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back, friends of the pod. We, part one, focused on article one of the Caring for Two, the awesome pharmacotherapy article series. And again, joined by two amazing special guests, senior authors, Melissa Thompson-Basson and Allie Langford. The first episode really has kind of focused a lot on just pharmacotherapy in the critically ill patients, and a lot of those kind of ICU disease states that many of us are probably familiar with and treat, and just considerations in this population. So we're going to shift gears here a little bit here and kind of more focus on like what you'd consider pregnancy-related complications, right? So, you know, we talked about the most common cause of pregnancy-related death, but what's actually the leading cause of pregnancy-related ICU admission?
Yeah, so one of the leading causes of ICU admission is obstetric hemorrhage. And this is kind of generally defined by the timing during the pregnancy at which hemorrhage occurs. It can occur in the first trimester. It can occur associated with procedural, like a miscarriage, or if someone's having a DNC. It can be associated antenatally. So we think of common causes in that period being placenta previa. We think of placental abruption. Certainly vasa previa, which is, although a very rare cause, can be associated with high fetal morbidity and mortality. And then we think of intrapartum and as well as postpartum. So intrapartum, more along the lines of uterine rupture. And postpartum, the most common causes of postpartum hemorrhage include uterine atony, perineal laceration, so whether it's on the perineum or a cervical laceration, retained products of conception, and then the dreaded, certainly, placenta accreta spectrum disorders, which nobody ever wants to be but surprised by one of those. But that can also be one of the leading causes of hemorrhage that certainly requires emergent surgical intervention.
And I think this is one of the things that this article does best, is not only describe what these conditions are, kind of highlight how they're a little different, but then there's also figures that kind of give you a visual for some of those things for our visual learners. Because sometimes just hearing those things, it's hard to picture or keep them apart. So definitely something to go and read and look at all those things, and what an awesome figure. And when we're thinking about obstetric hemorrhage, right, one of the things that I think of, when I got introduced to the emergency department, a lot of these automated dispensing cabinets, they have an obstetric hemorrhage kit. So what I thought could be useful is let's kind of go through one of these quote unquote virtual kits, and let's discuss a little bit of the pharmacotherapy, because as you open this up for the first time, it's going to have some drugs that you may be less familiar with if this is your first time seeing this kit. So many of the agents in the kit, you'll see them described as uterotonics. So what does that exactly mean?
So uterotonics are just describing a class of medications that can cause smooth muscle vasoconstriction and essentially uterine contraction. So our objective is to increase the tone of the uterus, because one of the pillars of stopping bleeding after delivery is that uterine constriction. So you get clamping down on those spiral arteries. So that's what's actually going to stop the bleeding. And as uterine atony is the most common cause of postpartum hemorrhage, you know, these are medications that I use on a daily basis.
So the most commonly used agent appears to be oxytocin. So how does this work? And then I think, can we talk a little bit about the dosing? Because if you look this up on you know, Micromedics or Lexicomp, you'll see IM, you know, IV bolus. You'll see continuous IV. So what are some considerations from a dosing perspective?
Yeah, so oxytocin is probably the most commonly associated medication, I think, with childbirth. But it's a polypeptide produced by the posterior pituitary. And its main therapeutic goal is to induce myometrial contractions. So for the indication for postpartum hemorrhage, it can be given IM, it can be given IV. You know, given its really short half-life of around like 5 or so minutes, it's most effective as a continuous infusion. And so you're going to be looking at an IV loading dose, potentially IM while establishing access, and a continuous infusion. And the dosing ranges are wide. They wide and vary. And, you know, it's usually titrated to a sustained uterine contraction that can be, you know, monitored in multiple ways. But I think we're also looking at the amount of bleeding as well. you're not going to be seeing repeat IM doses of this medication. It's going to be most effective titrated rapidly to your therapeutic effect, which is the sustained injections.
That's a really good pearl of kind of giving it IM first as your if IV access isn't established. And one of the things that the article points out is a lot of this is going to be institution specific. So look at your order set, your smart pumps and things, and make sure what you're doing you can give safe and those types of things. Because yeah, wide confidence intervals, wide dosing on that thing, looking at all the kind of wide variety you could have. So if oxytocin monotherapy is insufficient, if we, we're still dealing with our hemorrhage, what's a second line treatment in this kind of virtual kit that we'll commonly see?
We are always using oxytocin as what we call the active management of the third stage of labor. So, regardless of risk factors, every patient will get oxytocin, which I think is important for kind of non-obstetric providers to know. So the timing of administration also varies, but generally after either delivery of the anterior shoulder, delivery of the fetus, or the neonate at that point is when the oxytocin is initiated. And one of the cool little clinical pearls that I like to tell providers is, if you have a patient that maybe is your patient that has cardiomyopathy or some valvulopathy that you're really trying to maintain euvolemia and you really worry about that additional volume of 500 or a liter bolus of, your LR or saline, but you can give it in small aliquots IV, just like Melissa had said. You could do even 3 units IV. Observe, make sure the patient doesn't become hypotensive, and you can repeat that about every 3 to 5 minutes, and we'll do up to about 10 units that way. And that's my preferred administration technique for my cardiac patients. But to your question, Nick, if oxytocin is not effective and I'm reaching for a second line agent, I'm certainly considering, does this patient have any contraindications to either what we call Methergine, Hemabate, or Misoprostol? And it's often, if someone has persistent uterine atony, I'm kind of thinking 2 and 3 steps down the line, we're getting a second IV access. We're potentially drawing our CBC and our coags. We're calling our anesthesia colleagues just to say, hey, we're having more bleeding than what we would think. And I am starting to use 2 and 3 uterotonics. But my preferred second agent is Methergine. It's contraindicated in patients that have hypertension, so that does take your preeclamptic patients out, unless you're having such a severe hemorrhage that those patients are now hypotensive and you're sort of reaching for anything at that point. You could use it in that scenario, but we still do try to avoid it. And both Methergine and Hemabate, are given intramuscular.
I like that you pointed out that kind of the first two agents can be given parenterally, but another agent in the kit that you mentioned, right, Misoprostol, can be given IV or IM. What's the pearl with how this is commonly administered?
Yeah, so Misoprostol, when we're reaching for this for these postpartum hemorrhage patients, it's a prostaglandin E1. It's kind of hit the news a lot lately, if you will, but it's a very useful tool in our box. So it can be given orally, sublingually. It can be or administered intravaginally or intraarterially, actually. The oral route is preferred, and it has the fastest onset of action and sublingual as well. And so I think, those would be the two preferred initial routes of administration for a patient who requires it.
And just to add on to that as well, I do love Misoprostol. I think depending on your clinical scenario, so if you're doing a C-section and you're not able to access, rectal route administration easily, that's when we sort of go to the oral or sublingual, or we'll just or buccal route where we'll have the anesthesiologist just put the tablets because our patients are awake and generally talking to us, so we can do the buccal route. Certainly, we couldn't do that if they were intubated, but in a vaginal delivery, sometimes it's actually preferred, especially if they have an epidural, just to do it rectally. So it really depends on mode of delivery, and kind of if the patient, what is the easier access route.
So it feel like three of the more commonly used agents that you'll see definitely in the kits. What are some other agents that you might see that maybe aren't used on everybody, but they'll be in the kit? You may have to use them for select cases.
Yeah, so we talked about Methergen and Hemabate, which actually are what we consider on labor and delivery cold meds. So you may not find them in your obstetric hemorrhage kit per se, but they are instrumental in hemorrhage management. So as soon as you identify and you're calling for that obstetric hemorrhage kit, someone should be getting the Methergen and the Hemabate out of your Pyxis. Other things that kind of go along with the kit but may not technically be in would be, we could consider transoxamic acid, which is something that I really like to utilize early on. You know, it's not something, studies haven't shown that administering it prophylactically has shown huge benefit, but it is helpful in patients where you're experiencing some additional bleeding. And then some of the other things that is really helpful, oftentimes you'll have algorithms or guidelines in your hemorrhage kit, because in an emergency, it's always really helpful to reference, hey, what's the dose of Methergen? What's the dose of Hemabate? Because sometimes it's hard to remember those things when you're dealing with a true obstetric emergency, but generally you'll have additional IV tubing. You'll have all your tubes to draw your blood. Oftentimes you'll have different types of, whether it's an intrauterine balloon that can tamponade the uterus, or actually there's a new device now that actually creates suction and helps sort of simulate the compression of those spiral arteries. So those two types of uterine devices should also often be in the hemorrhage kit.
The device world comes up with cooler and cooler interventions and things. So what a novel approach. I would be remiss if we didn't ask, right, when we're thinking about obstetric hemorrhage and probably blood products, can we use viscoelastic testing, right, TEG or Rotem? Do we know if it's, can we use this to guide our replacement like we do in some other populations?
We definitely can. I think, you know, there has been studies that look at a baseline TEG in an obstetric patient, because we know patients are actually hypercoagulable. So it's important to note that there are subtle differences in your viscoelastic testing. The other thing that I would encourage providers is that you don't want to wait always for the results of these tests. Specifically, you don't want to wait for the results of your CBC and your coags if someone is actively bleeding. Oftentimes, and this is what Melissa talked about very early on, but those physiologic changes of pregnancy that pregnant patients can compensate so well before they show signs of significant blood loss. So patients may not even mount tachycardia until they've lost 20% of their blood volume. So it's important to have a high index of suspicion, call for blood early, implement your uterotonics early, and those, you know, uterine compression devices or uterine tamponade devices, and call for help. But the TEG or the Rotem, whatever the institution, your institution uses, are really helpful for ongoing resuscitation. But if you are bleeding and you've lost more than a liter or 1500 mLs of blood, then I would suggest just moving forward with blood product resuscitation.
This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Shifting gears here a little bit into ectopic pregnancies, they can be life-threatening enough certainly to lead to an ICU admission. But I think for our less life-threatening scenarios, it's an indication, especially if you're in the emergency department, you're working evenings or nights, a lot of those colleagues can see more of these patients on a regular basis, maybe in our low acuity areas. So how is this diagnosed? And maybe just talk a little bit about like what's happening physiologically.
So yeah, this is something that, you know, it becomes the bread and butter of our ED providers, and we certainly rely on them heavily for the workup and the diagnosis. So, you know, certainly any patient with a positive pregnancy test and absence of findings of an intrauterine pregnancy, we get concerned about an ectopic pregnancy. And while we most commonly think of an ectopic pregnancy implanting in the fallopian tube, ectopic pregnancy just truly is just defines an embryo that implants outside of the uterus. So that can be in the cornua of the uterus, it can actually be in the cervix, it can be in a previous C-section scar, it can be in the fallopian tube, or even elsewhere in the abdomen, which thankfully that is incredibly rare. But just having a, you know, if you know a patient has a positive pregnancy test and we don't see something in the uterus, then you sort of say, okay, what is the next best test to help identify the location of this pregnancy? And oftentimes, transvaginal ultrasound is going to be our gold standard to diagnose, and identify the location of the pregnancy.
So you mentioned a gold standard for diagnosis. Do we have a gold standard of treatment?
So there is medical management and there's surgical management. And again, this is a patient-centered, individualized approach. There are certainly contraindications to medical approach. So when we talk about medical management, we talk about the use of methotrexate, which is a chemotherapeutic agent that's a folate antagonist and inhibits DNA synthesis. But, you know, taking a detailed history on the patient, it's contraindicated in patients that are breastfeeding, have any liver or renal dysfunction, alcohol use disorders, and hematologic disorders. And even those patients that you're not sure are going to be the most reliable to follow up because it requires serial beta-HCG quantification. So you have to have a very reliable patient that you know that you can test that because it may require additional dosing. And surgical management is either what's called a salpingectomy, where we go and we actually remove the fallopian tube, which is more common than something called a salpingostomy. And that's really where we actually open the fallopian tube and remove the ectopic pregnancy, but that's associated with additional scarring and actually increases subsequent risk of ectopic pregnancy and in future pregnancies.
And I think one of the big things you like the article even points out is being extra diligent when you're verifying these orders. People are listening like, I'm diligent every time. Yes, I believe you, but this one where you got to be sure because it's based on your BSA, right? So milligrams per meter squared. So say someone has a height entered wrong, right? And it's in centimeters and not inches or something like that. You know, the article points out a reference where these have led to really big dosing errors from something that can, all of us have seen weights and heights entered wrong. That is not an uncommon thing in the hospital. So paying attention, making sure you don't see anything strange, always double checking, definitely feels like a medication safety plug from that perspective. Now, in pregnancy-related hypertensive emergencies, what are our most common end organ dysfunctions? What are going to be the things that kind of bring these patients into, let's say, our emergency department?
Pregnancy, hypertension of pregnancy is generally considered a spectrum of disorders. And we're talking about like the preeclamptic patient that moves into eclampsia. I know we're going to get to all of that, but it's important to remember that this is a spectrum and there are different ranges for severity. And so I don't think this is too much different than hypertension without pregnancy, but you know, common organs that take a big hit would be the kidneys. So monitoring serum creatinine, monitoring protein in the urine can help diagnose preeclampsia itself. LFT abnormalities as well, so liver injuries. I think probably one of the most concerning organs that can be affected is neurologic function. And so a couple of things can happen here. Headache can ensue in these patients that develop vasospasms from their hypertension or hypertension of gestational hypertension, and then seizure, of course. So yeah, I think it's a similar spectrum that you would see with non-pregnant patients, but very, very close monitoring, and very close treatment ranges as well when it develops.
What are our like goal blood pressures? Does that kind of the treatment algorithm stay the same that it kind of depends, or do we have a general recommendation?
You know, I think that we really just want to get initially get the patient out of the severe range. So I think that definition is probably a little bit different from your non-obstetric population. So when we consider preeclampsia with severe features, that's defined by a blood pressure, a systolic blood pressure greater than 160, or a diastolic blood pressure greater than 110. Preeclampsia without severe features, by blood pressure criteria, is that range between 140 and 160 and 90 to 110. But our objective in that acute phase when the patient presents with severe features is to get them out of that severe range and really keep them closer to 130s to 150s, over 70s to 90s if possible.
And we've highlighted in earlier discussion about considerations with IV kind of acute vasoactives and things. But what is a consideration with kind of IV versus oral routes in these patients? Like, what's kind of our first line? Are we reaching for the IV, or with the considerations in pregnancy, are we trying to do more of a oral kind of like a hypertensive urgency approach?
Yeah, the approach for these patients is much more urgent to get these blood pressures out of the severe range. And so, if a pregnant patient hits that severe range, they're going to be admitted for IV therapy. A lot of centers probably have like an OB triage center or some type of emergency room where they'll be referred to. The common agents that we're going to see, IV labetalol, IV hydralazine. It's kind of hurting my pharmacy heart to say that because we're like so anti-labetalol and hydralazine in every other critical care scenario, but they're fully indicated here because the therapeutic goals are to immediately reduce this blood pressure. And depending on where the patient is in the gestational age of the fetus, this patient might be moving on to induction for delivery, depending on how old the gestational age is. So, no, immediate goals are to get the patient out of the severe range of less than 160 to less than 110 with IV therapy, and then initiating oral therapy. And I think, the most common two drugs you're going to see are labetalol and nifedipine. And this applies too for as well. If you have a preeclamptic patient who's managed on these therapies as an outpatient and comes into your hospital for pneumonia, right? Do not hold her blood pressure medicines. I think in the ICU, our data suggests a systolic blood pressure of around 200 with issues, right? Then we start really worrying, but you really have to be in tune to the indication for this patient's antihypertensive regimen and adding that back quickly. Of course, in line with the hemodynamics and the blood pressures that you're seeing. But yeah, these agents will get titrated up rapidly, orally, and hopefully can keep this patient out of the severe range.
And I think, Melissa brings up such a salient point about, the use of antihypertensives in the acute phase and getting them out of that, because we know that women are at increased risk of stroke even when the systolic blood pressure is in the 150s to 160s. And that's why we are so aggressive about bringing down that systolic blood pressure. And there are some scenarios when, these patients actually, although they appear overall total body water up, they are intravascularly hypovolemic. So sometimes getting access can be really challenging. And in that scenario, I'll use short-acting nifedipine, like 10 milligrams of pionifedipine, if I can't get IV access. I will say, while it works rapidly, it can sometimes drop the blood patients very, very quickly, and actually the fetus can not tolerate that as well. So I prefer the IV agents, but just know that if you're in the emergency room and for whatever reason you can't get access on a patient, that the immediate release nifedipine is an option as well.
When I think of preeclampsia, kind of the next thing that comes to my non-OB trained mind is MAG, right? That's kind of one of the very few things that like MAG, oxytocin, some of those things. So is there a consensus on using magnesium? When I say MAG, magnesium sulfate, right? IV magnesium in preeclampsia. Like, is this something we're routinely doing? Do we know things like dosing and that kind of stuff yet?
Yeah, absolutely. So preeclampsia with severe features, and we can kind of delve into what defines severe features, but That is the indication for magnesium sulfate. We used to use magnesium sulfate for preeclampsia with and without severe features. We have gotten away. We know that that risk of progression to eclampsia, which is what we are ultimately trying to prevent with magnesium sulfate, the risk is significantly reduced in the population without severe features, although it does exist. But we are targeting the population of preeclampsia with severe features. And that's going to be defined a couple ways. So, certainly the blood pressure criteria that we discussed with the systolic blood pressure greater than 160 or the diastolic blood pressure greater than 110. And when we commonly think of preeclampsia, we think of proteinuria. So, the presence of now we sort of are using the protein creatinine ratio because we have it back much faster than a 24-hour urine. So, a protein creatinine ratio of 0.3 or greater. And let's say a patient doesn't have proteinuria, then they can have other lab abnormalities that will characterize them as preeclampsia with severe features. And that's going to be, LFTs that are twice the upper limit of normal, thrombocytopenia with a platelet count less than 100,000, renal dysfunction with a creatinine greater than 1.1, or essentially doubling of their baseline creatinine if they have underlying CKD. The presence of persistent neurologic symptoms, so that headache that Melissa talked about, or the kind of scotomata in the central aspect of their vision, or right upper quadrant pain associated with nausea, vomiting. Those certainly can categorize a patient as preeclampsia with severe features as well. And I think Nick, you had maybe asked about dosing. The IV dosing is a loading dose of 4 to 6 grams, generally over 20 to 30 minutes, followed by a maintenance dose of 1 to 2 grams per hour. And we're looking to try to get to a therapeutic window of about 4.8 to 9.6 milligrams per deciliter. And it's very institution specific, I will say, as to whether patient or whether providers do magnesium levels, or if they, for us specifically at University of Maryland, we actually look at reflexes, and that sort of are every 6 hours, or sorry, every 2 hours, we will do deep tendon reflexes because we know that there is a progression in the deep tendon reflexes before some patient will have any of the other side effects, such as like respiratory depression or anything like that.
Can't talk about preeclampsia, I feel like, without at least addressing a little bit of eclampsia. So let us in, let the listeners who may be less aware, even myself, what exactly is eclampsia?
Eclampsia is when a patient develops seizures. And in general, they are generalized tonic-clonic seizures. In the absence of a history of any seizure disorder or other potential medications or drugs that could cause the seizure. So it's essentially a diagnosis almost of exclusion in that they have no personal history of seizures and nothing else could have contributed to those seizures. And, one of the honestly, scariest things about eclampsia is that you don't have to have all of the warning signs of preeclampsia with severe features. Sometimes eclampsia is the presenting symptom. And that's really critical for our postpartum moms and kind of, the symptoms to be aware of and when to seek medical care as a postpartum mom, because that's generally the greatest risk. And the greatest risk for eclampsia is generally within the 24 hours after delivery. And that's why we continue the magnesium sulfate.
So that answered one of my questions of, do we continue the magnesium? The second question would be, are we still using anti-seizure medications in this scenario, or is it more focused on magnesium or other non kind of ASM treatments?
Yeah, so the treatment is still focused on magnesium. Certain things that are important is if you have a patient with preeclampsia with severe features that's already on magnesium, the most common reason that they would progress to eclampsia is that they're subtherapeutic. So if you have a patient on a continuous infusion, they have an eclamptic seizure, you want to actually rebolus the magnesium sulfate. So you're giving an additional 4 to 6 gram bolus to try to get them in that therapeutic window. And certainly we do get our neurointensive care colleagues on board any patient that has an eclamptic seizure, for me, I always do imaging. Initially, I'll get a CT head to make sure I rule out a bleed. And generally, if stable, I'll get an MRI for the patient as well, because there's something that we worry about called posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, or PRESS. So we always want to evaluate for that in patients that have eclampsia as well.
So again, everyone, download this, these two-part articles, May and July, Pharmacotherapy Journal. I think I could literally steal these two for 4 hours and not be able to ask all the questions from these two articles. So be sure to do that. But let's kind of end with, there have been some maintenance or some global thoughts, things that you have kind of, you know, I've heard repeated a little bit throughout our discussion here. So as we wrap up, what are some big take-home points or things to re-emphasize when we're thinking about the care of the critically ill patient who's pregnant? Throughout the episode, we've talked about patient-specific considerations. And I really like that phrase, you know, just in critical care in general. But are there other things we can do to help these patients that maybe we haven't talked about? Maybe it's not on the, it's not something that we would do or even intervene on in other patients in the ICU.
So for all of our pharmacists who are taking care of patients in your medical ICU, for example, and you have a patient come in who, a recently postpartum patient, one of the first things I think about is, you know, what were the on the home ed list, right? Like, was this patient being treated for preeclamptic hypertension? Do we need to consider blood pressure management? Resuming the prenatal vitamin, please restart these patients' vitamins. And then let's go ask our patient what their breastfeeding plans were prior to delivery, right? Because every mom, most moms go into this with a plan for that and a plan for their infant. And when they become unable to make their own decisions in the ICU, it's up to us to determine what their wishes were prior to that event. And that's true for everything that we have, that we do for our patients. And that should include their desires for or for not breastfeeding their infant. And so I find myself making this recommendation a lot, where we have a patient who just got admitted and has a baby in the NICU. And she's on the ventilator for severe pneumonia, and my team is just kind of going about their day like nothing's different. And I'll say, well, what were her breastfeeding goals? Do we need to get a lactation consult? And if we didn't, we still need to get lactation on board, because if we don't address this, it could turn into mastitis, which could turn into a severe infection with a lot of implications. And so, you know, we might not be giving this milk to the baby, but establishing supply early on after delivery is extremely important for the long-term success of breastfeeding. And it shouldn't be something that we're shying away from talking about, because it's a very, very important part of bonding with mom and infant. And it's a very patient-centered intervention, and honestly, a really easy intervention. If you just think about the whole picture of this patient as they came in and what's going on with baby, and it could be something that makes or breaks that experience for that patient when she wakes up and she realizes that, oh, my family did know I wanted to breastfeed, and they were able to get a lactation nurse up here to help me establish my milk supply, and now I have a milk supply for my infant. I mean, how powerful is that, right, for our patients? And so I've made that recommendation, I can't even count how many times, but that is something that I think of immediately when we have immediately postpartum patients in our unit.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as the obstetric provider, we can't emphasize our appreciation enough for that consultation and consideration for lactation. Just as you pointed out, you know, this critically ill obstetric patient, they are at really high risk for perinatal mood disorders and PTSD. And I think, you know, they don't have the opportunity to necessarily do skin to skin or have that initial bonding. So I think anything we can do to facilitate, and if that simply is to establish the milk supply with breastfeeding, then that is a critical intervention that, as you said, it's an easy intervention, but it can make a huge difference in the long-term mental health of the patient. So we really appreciate that. And certainly, you know, always considering the discussion of contraception, not that that has to be done by a critical care provider, but considering it, because, you know, patients are at risk for long-term medical problems given the for whatever indication that they were sent to the ICU. So it's an important discussion to have, and oftentimes our patients are lost for follow-up. So just establishing, communication and talking about again their wishes and truly being patient-centered, I think is the most valuable.
Incredibly wise words from you both. I think I could try to steal you both for about 4 hours to try to talk through all the things we could with the article. So again, encourage everyone, pharmacotherapy, May and July issues, be sure to download this. But what are there a couple points or a big thing you want to reemphasize for the listeners when you're thinking about the care of the critically ill pregnant patient?
Yeah, one thing that we hear a lot on rounds, right, is we treat mom first. We always treat mom first. And while that is still very true, I think there is a lot of finesse available with medication selection. And if we know the tools available to us to understand how these drugs, if they would enter the placenta, if they have teratogenic effects, et cetera, and at what time during organogenesis, I think we can accomplish both. Treating mom in an evidence-based way and minimizing harm to the fetus. And it's going to require a lot more time on the pharmacist's behalf at the bedside. Like, you, this is not knowledge we have off the top of our heads. We're going to be referencing these materials. I'm just very proud to be a part of the group that put these papers together, because I know that they are at my fingertips when I have more patients coming through and reviewing things and thinking about things. But, I don't want us to just start carte blanche thinking that, oh, just treat the mom and we'll deal with the consequences, because we'll hear that a lot from providers in the ICU. And while that is true, there's a lot we can do to make this as safe as possible.
Yeah, I echo everything Melissa said. I think it's truly a multidisciplinary approach to these patients, and having a pharmacy team available to help with medication management is really important for these patients. I think it's underutilized. I wish I had a pharmacist on labor and delivery with me on a daily basis to round. But please take advantage of the pharmacist that you have in the ICU, because it really makes a huge difference for these patients.
So huge, 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 huge thanks to both Allie Langford and Melissa Thompson-Baston, not only for all you and your fellow authors did on these two articles, but for taking so much time out of your day to come in here, dive into the details, and even talk about some considerations that didn't necessarily make it into the article. Myself and the listeners greatly appreciate both of your time and expertise. So thank you both so much.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
And another just massive thank you to both Allie Langford and Melissa Thompson-Baston. Reach out. Melissa's on Twitter at MTBaston. So definitely reach out, not only to tell them what an awesome job those pharmacotherapy two-part articles are, but also how great they were on these two episodes. Two of the absolute best and smartest. So very, very lucky to work and get their insight. It was awesome. Reminder, March Madness bracket, right? It's the 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness bracket. It's happening right now. So Twitter or Instagram at Pharmacy to Dose, so you can vote on what is ultimately the best trial in critical care history. So please reach out. If you have other ideas, let me know about this. Other things, remember, at Pharmacy to Dose on social media, pharmacy2dose.com, the website, as well as pharmacy2dose@gmail.com if you want to shoot me an email message. But until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only and does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials on the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN.
ACP and the Critical Care Parent disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.